the difficulty with the publicity release that's held at the laboratory, and this was the largest publicity affair that GE had ever held up to that point, nothing was given in detail. There were no descriptions of how it was done, no descriptions of apparatus. It was just a plain publicity release indicating to the world that GE had made diamonds. I was pretty sure after this letter that GE people would do something to try and placate me, and certainly after having synthesized diamonds, a fellow would be entitled to a raise. I had been passed over on raises, as I remember it now, for some 4 or 5 years, when most of the fellows were getting a raise every year. And this was really beginning to bother me, and I thought I'd probably better get out and get myself a job somewhere else. Well, after making diamonds and after developing this high-pressure apparatus, I felt that I had finally shown my mettle and that the company had come around. But I had in my own mind kind of set my own limits on things. I forget what I was making at the time. Probably somewhere around $10,000. Something like that. I had obtained raises, but they'd been the automatic variety that was coming along with the union raises that were coming. I think I had only received one official raise that was a raise over and above this. But I had decided in my own mind that if the company didn't, when they came around to give me a little bit of reward for this diamond business work, but if my salary wasn't set at $15,000, and I wasn't going to argue with them about it, this had to be voluntary. If when Marshall came to me, he said, "We're raising your salary to $15,000, I'll stay with the company. If they don't raise me to anything like that, I'm going to leave." Well, Marshall came around a few days after this letter, all right. Came around to everybody. Everybody that worked on the project got a raise. Of course, I had no way of knowing what the other fellows received. But as I remember, my raise brought me somewhere up around $12,000 or $13,000, something in that neighborhood. So it wasn't, I had set a minimum. And I had heard from things that I had read that there were a few people in the lab who were making as high as $35,000 a year. I had heard that there was at least one in our own physical chemistry area that was making $18,000. So I figured this $15,000 was a minimum, and I really had hopes that that they might do better than that. Well, at that point, I decided that I would leave the lab. I felt confident of my own ability and thought that I would stand to gain more by leaving than staying. And because I gauged that what they pay you in dollars is a pretty good gauge of what they think of you. Well, when Marshall came, I was fairly sullen about the whole thing, and let him know that I didn't particularly think that was a very big raise for such an accomplishment, and asked him what I could expect for the future. Whereupon he told me that would depend entirely upon what I did for the lab subsequently. If I pulled off something good a year from now, I'd get a raise again and so on. Well, I thought that a guy ought to be worth a little ride for a while after making diamonds, after all the effort they've gone into this sort of thing over the past 125 years. Well, I let Irene know at the University of Utah that I might be interested in another job. I was offered a job at the University of Utah, but didn't like the salary, mainly, as I remember it. Shortly thereafter, the word somehow got to Wilkinson. He needed a director of research, and I had correspondence with Harvey Fletcher, who was dean of the College of Physical Engineering Sciences and also Director of Research, in correspondence with Fletcher and Wilkinson, I came out to the Y, April conference time in 1955, and after thinking it over for only a week or a little more, decided that I would come to Brigham Young University as their Director of Research and Professor of Chemistry, and I've been in that position to this day. Well, I guess I ought to get back to the other story a little bit. Unfortunately, after getting back to the other story, I pushed the wrong button on this tape recorder, and I've gone off 500 feet of tape here, so with nothing recorded. I just hope that I can remember what I said and that I don't duplicate what's already on the tape prior to this mishap. I might say one other thing. when NERAD, my immediate boss, became aware that I might be looking for another job, and of course he suspected this as soon as I asked for permission to make the trip out to Brigham Young University for a couple of days. He got in a huddle with the marshal and came back to see what they couldn't do to keep me around one way or another. They offered me the job of manager of the diamond business in Detroit. It was only in the planning stage at this point, but it was planned. The manufacturing pilot plant operation at first, of course, would be set up at Detroit. And they offered me the responsibility of this job. Well, I turned that down right off. Later, though, NERAD got hold of me, and he said, "Now look, Chase," he says, "you stay around. Don't you take another job." He says, "We'll get more money for you here." So I asked him how much. He says, "Well," he says, "I can't do it all at once, but," he says, "within a very short time, we'll get $20,000 a year for you." Well, I don't to this day know whether to believe that or not. At the time, I didn't believe it. I just thought that was more kidding, just kidding me along, and that NERAD or no one else would, in a short period of time, get me up about $20,000. Well, I don't know. Maybe they would have. Well, now to try and get back to the story again. I'm all mixed up at this point on what I've said and what I haven't said. The company held the largest press release that they've ever held on the 15th of February of 1955. Correspondents from all around the world were invited to Schenectady. They didn't tell them what they were coming for. They just said, "We have something big. Come to Schenectady at our expense and we'll tell you all about it." Well, when both these correspondents came into New York City, they were loaded onto planes and flown to Schenectady. When they were once on the plane, on the flight to Schenectady, they were given brochures telling about the synthesis of diamond. Now, this was supposed to have been the first information that was out on the synthesis, but there'd been a leak somewhere because the British Broadcasting Company, we learned later, had broadcast at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. This was about 10 a.m. when these correspondents were on the plane. The BBC had announced that GE says they've made diamond. I came to the Y September 1st of 1955 as the Director of Research and Professor of Chemistry. Shortly after arriving here, I had a phone call from Chauncey Suits, who said that they were going to present the first diamond to the Smithsonian Institution. Well, I asked him which first diamond, whereupon he informed me that it was to be Herb Strong's diamond. This diamond, I may have already mentioned, was given to the president of the General Electric Company, Ralph J. Cordner. Well, I told Suits that I didn't think that would be very wise in view of the fact that there had never been a duplication of this synthesis of Herb's diamond. And certainly there's been a long history of people claiming to have made diamonds, and no one had been able to duplicate them. Furthermore, Herb's diamond was atypical. The diamonds that we were now making, based on the process discovered by me and variations thereof, were polycrystalline diamonds, tiny octahedra intergrown, completely different than this diamond of Herb Strong. Well, I didn't go to Washington, and I told Suits that if he presented this diamond to the Cunning Institution of Washington, he ought to at least tell them that it had never been possible to duplicate this particular synthesis. And if he did present it, I was going to write and tell a Smithsonian that this was the case. Well, I heard no more from him, but I learned later that Strong and Bundy and Winthorpe and Suits and others had gone to Washington and presented diamonds to the Smithsonian Institution. They didn't present Herb's diamond, but they presented some diamonds that had been synthesized in the laboratory, a little half thimbleful or something. But the plaque reads that these were the first diamonds synthesized in the General Electric Laboratory. Well, it wouldn't have been bad if they'd have said these are some of the early diamonds made in the GE Laboratory, but it says these were the first diamonds made in the General Electric Laboratory. Well, it's amazing to me that men in Suits' position will be dishonest this way, and it's amazing to me that Strong and Winthorpe and Bundy, whom on casual acquaintance appeared to be the nicest Christian gentlemen you could imagine, would go along with things like this. One thing I had noticed, though, particularly about Strong and Bundy, is that they are company men through and through. They go along with the company on anything that the company says, always have. In more recent years, Suits has published a flossy article purporting to be the history of the diamond synthesis effort at the General Electric Company. It's a multicolored pamphlet, very beautifully done, and they distributed thousands and thousands of copies of this. Suits presented it originally as a speech before the American Chemical Society Rochester section. I started through one of these at one time, marking up all the errors that were in it. Suits does his best in this to make a team effort out of the thing, make it a company effort. Historical sequences in the thing are incorrect. He makes an attempt in that to show that the belt was a joint accomplishment of Strong and myself, when in fact the belt was strictly my own invention and development. And in general, plays it from all angles to make it appear that the thing was... I have the impression that a great deal of what was done at GE was done to save the skins of the bosses. I can't quite understand this. They had said that they had to have this huge 1,000-ton double-acting press to do the job, and then when it was not needed because of the belt apparatus, they still wanted the president of the company to feel that this had all been done in that big press that they had purchased. And I think a lot of what went on was done from that standpoint. The other thing was that they deliberately wanted to submerge an individual and make this a company achievement rather than an individual achievement. In the long run, I think the company may have made out a lot better by allowing it to be an individual achievement. I don't know whether I've already said it, but I better say it again to make sure. My synthesis was repeated on the 31st of December of 1954 by Hugh Woodbury, and later on, under the supervision of company management, and because the patent attorneys felt that it was necessary, had Hugh Woodbury make three separate runs, and Richard Oriani make three separate runs, without my being around, in order to make sure that there was no monkey business. Well, fortunately, each of these men made diamonds in all three of their runs using the original process that I discovered using the iron sulfide in the graphite tube in the presence of the tantalum disk. So, after I had been making diamonds for about a month, Wentorf returned from the vacation he'd been on, and then using my apparatus immediately started making variations of the process. For iron, he substituted nickel and cobalt and other things. Don't believe he substituted nickel. I think that Herb Strong substituted the nickel later on. But it was eventually found by simple substitution of these transition elements that any of these metals were capable of synthesizing diamonds up in this 95,000 atmosphere range in the neighborhood of 1,200 to 1,600 degrees centigrade. Now, we know that these pressures today were not as high as we thought they were then, but at least that's what we thought they were at that time. The wonderful thing about the synthesis was that the yields were fairly high. The diamonds could be synthesized in a couple of minutes' time. Pilot plant was soon established in Detroit, and by 1958, General Electric was selling diamonds. My understanding is that they sold more than 3 tons of this diamond grit now, using nickel as the catalyst, or alloys of nickel, iron, chrome, and aluminum, and other things as the catalyst these days. Let me make one brief statement at this point to summarize what I've been saying. The synthesis of diamonds at General Electric hinged very strongly on the development of apparatus. I developed the Belt apparatus in the face of opposition from the coal leagues and opposition from the company management. General Electric obtained this apparatus in spite of themselves. And then after having developed this Belt apparatus, I succeeded in synthesizing diamonds by a process that could be reproduced by others. And to our knowledge, this was the first time that man had ever synthesized diamonds that met all the scientific tests that need to be applied to prove that a synthesis has been made. I cannot comprehend to this day how come the GE management and my associates reacted in the manner that they did. Scientists in general have very powerful egos and are no different than other men, such as men seeking high position. Scientists obtain their reward in recognition and seem as anxious when the chips are down to step on other persons' necks if they have to get the recognition they seek, just as do politicians and others. The days at General Electric when this was going on were very difficult days for me and for Idaho's too. It's hard to describe the anguish and the problems that we have. And since I have always been a retiring person that doesn't push, even when I feel that I'm being wronged, it might be that if I had an entirely different kind of personality, of forward fighting, gregarious, in there pitching for what I feel are my rights, the outcome of the whole thing may have been entirely different. I don't know. Sometimes I had the feeling that there was a religious discrimination on account of the fact that I was a Mormon. I was, to my knowledge, the first Mormon to ever be employed by the General Electric Research Laboratory. Marshall used to tell some absolutely filthy jokes about the Mormons right in my presence. I've been rather reluctant to put this material down on tape. Ida Rose has been after me for years to do it. I keep saying the past is gone. Let's forget it. Let's just look to the future. But she felt that my own knowledge of the diamond synthesis and my own feelings and reactions, at least in part, ought to be put down on tape for our children and possibly future descendants. I have never knocked the General Electric Company since leaving General Electric. I have had only good to say about the company and the people. This is the first time that I have ever said anything of my inner feelings concerning the individuals or others with whom I worked. And I think, in all fairness, that I would say even today that one of the smartest things I ever did in my life was to kind of force myself upon the General Electric Company. That's the only way I got employed. And possibly the second smartest thing I ever did was quit them and come to the BYU in 1955. It's interesting to note that the DuPont people in 1948, when I obtained my PhD and was looking for a job, the DuPont people were particularly anxious to hire me. When this was all over and I had left the General Electric Company, the DuPont people who had tried to recruit me in the first place met me, I forget the occasion, and remembered me and told me that I didn't know it, but they too had been interested in diamond synthesis. And if I had synthesized diamonds for the DuPont Company instead of the General Electric Company, that even though I had quit the DuPont Company, I would continue to receive financial remuneration for my efforts. DuPont is one of the few companies that has kind of a royalty program whereupon when a fellow has a particularly outstanding achievement, and they give him a kind of a royalty that he collects for as many years as this particular achievement is making money for the DuPont company. Now, GE's system of rewards, of course, is based solely on the salary that they pay you, and when you leave the company, of course, that ends. Of course, a man has troubles in any kind of an endeavor, and my troubles didn't end when I left the General Electric Company. They followed me,
because I was not able to use my belt apparatus at Brigham Young University for research. Now, this was due at first to the company's own particular secrecy, and second to Department of Commerce secrecy that was put on my patent application on the belt apparatus. Now, I did try to work out that program whereby I could continue to use the apparatus with GE, but the terms that GE wanted was that they would receive and own everything that came out of any experiments I would perform with the belt apparatus. This, in spite of the fact that Brigham Young University and others might be supplying the money for the experiments. Well, these terms were not tolerable to me. Then, of course, I had to look for a way out of it. I had to get money to conduct my experiments. This all took time, but eventually, I did receive a grant from the Carnegie Institution in connection with the Tetrahedral Anvil Press. I had made a couple of trips to Washington to talk with people in the Department of Commerce about my continuing to use the belt apparatus. Now, I had kind of felt that I was the father of this ultra-high pressure, high-temperature research, that there was a lot of science in it besides the making of diamonds, and I wanted to use this apparatus to explore phenomena under these very high-pressure, high-temperature conditions. Well, the Department of Commerce people weren't very sympathetic. As a matter of fact, I know the GE personnel were in the wings, in other rooms there at the same time that I was there and after I last came in. But it just seemed that there was a too much personal business going on there between the Department of Commerce and the General Electric Company. And GE was determined. In fact, I heard it from Hal Bolenkirk himself that Abe Marsh and others at GE were out to get me. They were out to keep me from doing anything in this field. But on one of these visits to Washington, one of the Commerce people said, "Hall, we want to hang on to what we've got in the way of equipment that we know that we can use to make diamonds. We don't want the Russians to have this." I understand that all this business was based, all this secrecy was based on the fact that we didn't want the Russians to know how to make diamonds because the Russians didn't have access to diamonds. But you could tell from the literature and from what I had learned from geologists that the Russians had all the diamonds that they wanted in their own country, and this later proved to be true. Although I understand that the testimony of a single woman expert in the Department of Commerce, this woman was an expert on diamonds, on her single testimony, all the secrecy was justified. And she testified that the Russians did not have any diamonds. Well, as I was saying, this man in Commerce says, "Hall, this secrecy is all based on the patents. That's how we put it on. Why don't you invent another apparatus? And if you can, it'll be free for you to use, and we will not put secrecy on it." Well, I did finally devise this tetrahedral anvil press, and it's published in the literature, of course. I was real worried about it all the time. I thought in my own mind that it was clearly separately patentable from the belt apparatus, but I didn't know that. On talking to people about it, they said I was in a position to judge more than anyone else, but a real test could only probably come up in a court case. Well, on thinking about it, I finally decided that it certainly was separately patentable over the belt. So, I arranged to have patents applied for and submitted an article to the Review of Scientific Instruments and presented a paper at an American Chemical Society meeting, I believe it was in San Francisco, in the spring of 1958, and had this all arranged so that the paper would be published about a month after I gave my speech in San Francisco. Well, this all happened. It all went off real well. The thing went through the patent office on the first office action. No problems at all. Clearly inseparable, patentable. Then, a few months after all this, I received in the mail from the Department of Commerce a statement that this was all secret and that I had to inform everybody that knew anything about this apparatus that it was now secret. So they broke their verbal promise to me. You want to have everything in writing when you're dealing with government officials, I'm sure. Well, of course, it was impossible to write to all the 60,000 persons who subscribed to Review of Scientific Instruments. And